are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview. On tonight's program, Liz Olds talks with author Aaron Philip Clark about the second book in his Trevor Finnegan series, Blue Like Me.
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks for coming on to Right On Radio tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me. Happy to be
here. Welcome, welcome. Why don't we start with your reading from Blue Like Me?
Sure. I'll go ahead and start with chapter one. November 2016, Venice, California. Not everything's a victim. Some places around here still cling to life. Classic diners, coffee shops, dive bars, and time-worn lodges like the Surfside Motel, which harkens back to the 1950s when road-tripping families occupied rooms. Then came the free-loving bohemians, and now dope-sick junkies selling sex for money and drugs. It's how the motel survives, kept afloat by a steady stream of sex workers and johns who rent rooms by the hour. Located north of Lincoln, blocks away from the million-dollar homes. The motel is dismally kept, with white paint chipping from stucco and a decrepit sign advertising free cable TV. I sit parked on Rose Court in front of a quick-change oil shop. The street is a sprawling graveyard of failed businesses, a neighborhood that's gone under, ground zero for what could have been. I surveil two LAPD officers from the driver's seat of my 68 Ford Falcon Futura. The Falcon doesn't raise suspicion. It's forgettable, primer gray with speckled rust or what gearheads call cancer. It's the type of car that blends in on any street. If I park in a blue collar neighborhood, the Falcon is rarely the only classic on the block needing a paint job. In wealthier neighborhoods, it's easily a restoration project for a collector. In Venice, it fits in either category. Through my camera's Zeiss lens, I watch officers Chris Garvey and Brian Yoshida sit inside their parked black and white outside room 16. Garvey gets out of the unit. He's a tall white man with a physique that says he prefers weightlifting over cardio. Yoshida, a dark-haired man, swings the passenger side door open and vomits. Scoping the parking lot, Garvey doesn't look up, doesn't look put off by his partner's nasty showing. He reaches into the back seat and pulls out a cuffed, red-headed girl who looks barely old enough to buy cigarettes. He spins her to face the car, presses his pelvis against her backside, and grins. He moves her hair to the side and speaks into her ear. I don't need to be a lip reader to know the words repulse her, but the nights can chill to the bone, especially for girls wearing tight-fitting bikini tops, denim shorts cut high above their thighs, and slip-on gum-soled sneakers made famous by skateboarding Z-boys. I focus the lens on their legs, which are covered in sores and bruises. The girls look spent, sickly. I snap three medium shots, adjust the lens for a close-up on the cops' faces, and take three more pictures. If I didn't know any better, I'd say the girls are everyday surfers, not an uncommon sight in the area known as the ghetto by the sea. Girls who spend their days lying on the beach, occasionally riding the waves and scoring coke. The thought of them turning tricks in bathrooms and motels wouldn't enter my mind. Garvey uncuffs the girls and slips money into the redhead's back pocket. The girls walk into the motel's lobby. The officers get back into their patrol car, Garvey behind the wheel. When the girls return, they pass the black and white and walk upstairs to room 18. Garvey drives to the side of the building. I start the Falcon, pull out, and enter the motel's parking lot. The patrol car is parked near a dumpster where someone has discarded a stained mattress and mini fridge. I watch the officers get out, climb the stairs, and ready themselves for what awaits them in the room. They knock on the door, it opens. I snap pictures, a few dozen. They enter the room, the redhead shuts the door, and I know what comes next. The shots aren't enough. Every private eye knows the casket doesn't close without the money shot. I note two security cameras, one near the lobby's door and the other mounted on a wall pointing toward the stairs. There's nowhere to be sure if they're functioning, but I always presume they are. I adjust my hat's brim so it draws a heavy shadow over my face, lift the collar of my jacket to shield my neck and cheeks, and get out of the car, camera in hand. Walking upstairs, I can hear voices, giggles, and sensual moans. As I approach room 18, I reach for the door handle, hoping the redhead kept it unlocked. I turn it slowly and push. The door creaks, but I'm confident it's gone unheard, given the increasingly loud moans. The room feels like a humid morning, and there's a distinct smell, unpleasant, ripe. Bodies are contorted, folded like origami on two queen-sized mattresses. I squeeze my camera through the cracked doorway and gently press the red button. The light meter alerts me that the indigo glow from the TV isn't enough for full exposure. Damn it. If only the girls had turned on the vanity light over the sink, I'd have something to work with. I set the camera to auto, aware that the next shot will produce a flash. I've got 2 minutes, maybe three, once the pictures have been taken, before Garvey and Yoshida suspend their coitus and come after me. I push the button. There's a blinding white flare. The shutter rapidly opens and closes, taking several pictures a second. "What the hell?" Garvey says, pushing the naked girl off him. She shrieks, bouncing from the mattress to the floor. "Son of a bitch," he yells, searching for his underwear buried in the sheets. I take another picture of Garvey's ruddy face, slam the door, and run downstairs to the Falcon. Before getting in, I look back to see Yoshida with his gun drawn, making his way downstairs with Garvey close behind. Yoshida's agile in a way Garvey isn't. It seems to slide down the steps as if they were greased with bacon drippings.
Aaron Philip Clark, author of Blue Like Me, an excerpt from the book. Why don't we start, you know, you've got a lot of really nice complex characters in there, and the most complex is Trevor Finnegan, of course. Why don't you introduce us to him?
Sure. So Trevor Finnegan is a ex-LAPD officer. In the first book, Under Color of Law, we understand why he's an ex-officer by the end of that book, because he essentially gets himself in such a situation that he can no longer be a police officer. And so now he's become a private investigator, and he's working with a civil rights attorney. And what they've done is they set up kind of a tip line for people who can, and it's not quite a tip line, it's an email, but essentially people can reach out to them if they want to report wrongdoing by law enforcement and they don't feel comfortable going to the LAPD or the sheriff department or whoever they think may be able to provide some oversight if they see an officer doing something wrong. And so Trevor has been investigating some of these. He essentially spends his day sifting through some of these leads, and the ones that kind of pan out or seem like they could be legitimate are the ones that he spends his nights kind of investigating to see if there's some credibility there. And so he essentially is in some ways trying to redeem himself for some of the actions that he took as a police officer where he didn't uphold his mandate.
Yeah, the first episode that includes Riley and Sally Munoz, why don't you describe that? It's at the beginning of the book. I don't feel like it's a spoiler. And you can tell us kind of what happens and what sets off the whole story arc of the book.
Sure. So Trevor, his ex-partner, Sally Munoz, and it has come to the attention of the law firm that she potentially may be a dirty cop. And so he's tasked with having to surveil her and her current partner, Martin Riley. And so he surveils them to Venice Beach, and he essentially is kind of blending in as best he can, but he's watching them. He really has no clue what he's watching them for, particularly simply because he just knows that there could be something there that may reveal itself. And so he essentially is watching them as they enter a cannabis distillery. And so he is surveilling, and they come out, and Martin Riley is struck down by an assailant. And so Trevor quickly goes from this private investigator to eyewitness. His cop instincts kick in. He actually is armed. He decides to get involved, especially because his ex-partner, Sally, is wounded. as well. So the assailant takes off. Trevor then tends to Sally as best he can, but he also takes off after the assailant. A gun battle ensues in the parking lot, and the assailant essentially gets away. Trevor quickly realizes, hey, you're not a cop anymore. In fact, the LAPD is not a huge fan of yours. You probably should leave the scene immediately. And he does that, only to have Sally track him down later, knowing that he was an eyewitness and essentially demanding that he help her figure out who shot her partner.
She feels kind of left alone or abandoned, right?
Yes, very much so. You know, the relationship with police officers in terms of the partnership is very strong. Sometimes it could even be stronger than a marriage in the sense that the two individuals can spend more time together than someone may spend with their spouse. So she has a strong connection to Riley. He also looked after her after she returned from her maternity leave and had moved over to kind of narcotics advice squad. And so she feels the absence of Riley, having witnessed his murder. Part of it is she's very much in shock. And then also she's grieving, but she's not allowing herself really to go through any of that because she's so kind of hell bent on figuring out who killed her partner. And she believes she knows who did it. And it's without giving a whole lot away, it's really where she focuses all her attention. It's only once Trevor comes into the picture that we realize Sally may not be correct in her suspicions.
Let's change gears a little bit. Talk about Trevor's relationship with his dad.
Sure. So Trevor has a very complicated relationship with his father, Sean. And they, you know, Trevor lost his mother at a very young age. So his father was tasked with raising him. And his father is retired LAPD. And his father, in some ways, did the best he could, but he also caused quite a bit of trauma for Trevor as he was growing up. And so Trevor's need to become a police officer has a lot to do with he and his father's relationship. And so there's a lot of resentment there. There's a lot of blame. And I think Trevor's misfortune as a police officer, his father feels like that some of that is due to how he raised him. And so, you know, while his father is this alcoholic who has been a functioning alcoholic even when he was a cop, but now it's kind of spiraled out. He's having some health difficulties on account of alcoholism. And he's getting to the point where Trevor's quite concerned, maybe more concerned than he has been in the past about his father. And so he does rely on his father, though, because his father still has good cop instincts and he does bounce, you know, cases off of his father and tries to see what insight he can provide. But he's constantly, Trevor's constantly trying to get his father's approval. And that comes at a cost.
Los Angeles is also a big character in this book. Why don't you talk some about your relationship with Los Angeles and how it becomes a character in the book?
Sure. So I grew up here in LA, primarily Pasadena, so within LA County, although I've lived through different parts of LA off and on. And so oftentimes when I'm writing, I like to pull from some of the neighborhoods that I have experience with, either lived or worked. And Venice is a place where I actually is close to where I was going to grad school. So there's a chunk of the book that does take place on what we call the West Side, which is Venice and the beach communities. And so I really wanted LA to be a character in the book. And I wanted to make sure that I kind of layered the city the way that I see it, which is many layers. And it's a very interesting and robust and dynamic kind of place. There's this sense that anything could happen, you know, in LA at any given time. And so, you know, I definitely wanted to make that the centerpiece, so that it feels like there's some sprawl to the city. It feels like Trevor really travels. You know, one of the things that was important was to make sure that people understand in the book that it does take him a while to get places. So there's quite a bit of traffic. So sometimes, you know, I may read a review and it'll say, you know, well, it took him 3 hours to get, you know, to this place. Like, well, that's realistic.
It's true. You know? Yeah.
So, you know, if you're not in the carpool lane, you got to deal with regular old traffic. So, you know, LA adds a layer of tension there.
And you were in law enforcement in LA?
Yeah. So I did a year with the LAPD and then ultimately went out on injury and decided to go back to my original career, which was as an educator.
Oh, and where do you teach, or what do you teach, writing? Or I noticed on your website that you do
consultations,
reviews of writing, consultations. That's the word I'm looking for. So what kind of stuff do you do with your education?
Sure. So I teach creative writing at UCLA, and I also teach when I can courses that are kind of focused more on mystery. So I teach mystery 101, which is a kind of a foundational course that kind of goes through the history of noir and mystery fiction. And I teach a introduction to fiction course. We read a novel and we discuss it, and we talk about different genres, and the students are able to hopefully kind of start their own book in that course.
We've got about 6-7 minutes left, but I want to ask a couple of questions. Blue Like Me can stand alone, but it's also part of a series. And I'm wondering if your original novel started out as a part of a series, or if it was kind of the second part of the series kind of came just out of the first one without you really planning on it. And then do you like standalones, or do you like series better to write?
Well, so originally, yes. So the Trevor Finnegan, story arc is meant to be a series. So ideally I see maybe two more books, I think. It wasn't meant to be a very long series, not like an Easy Rollins, but who knows, things can change. But that's originally how I kind of saw it, you know, maybe 5 or 6 books total. But when I was writing Under Color of Law, the first book, I really started to think about the second book at the same time. So I started to outline the second book as I was writing the first book. And so I was able, as soon as I was done with Under Color of Law, to kind of roll into writing the second book. I do like standalones. I mean, I'm writing, I just finished a standalone last month. And so I'm in the process of kind of doing some edits. And then I'll hop back into the Trevor Finnegan world. But I wanted to kind of take a break and do something different. The standalone is a retelling of The Talented Mr. Ripley set in the world of hip hop music. And so I wanted to kind of do something that was a little bit away from the police thriller.
And what prompted you to do the Trevor Finnegan books in first person?
Well, I really wanted the reader to have a vicarious experience with Trevor. I wanted them to feel like they were in his shoes and experience everything kind of in real time. And so I tried to get as close to that as I could. And so I really felt like, you know, the close first person present tense was the best way to do that, and really get a sense of his interior, but also what he's experiencing.
Did you pretty much know in advance what was going on, or did you have to do a lot of research to get back into the knowledge of the LAPD, or how did that work?
No, I mean, luckily, it's still relatively fresh. I also still have quite a few of my training manuals. So if I did get stuck, I could kind of just, you know, have a quick refresher. So I use that as reference. And then I also have family members on the job who are police officers. So if I ever kind of need to, if I get stuck or I'm not too sure how to navigate something, I can ask one of my family members. I mean, some things obviously are going to be fictionalized and kind of invented simply because if I showed how it really happens, I'm not so sure how many people would be very interested in that because it could be kind of mundane. So, you know, going to court and things like that, you know, oftentimes we take that out of the book, you know, because it's just, it doesn't necessarily serve the plot. So, you know, there's always going to be some creative license there.
In terms of genre, do you feel like it's a straight up PI or do you feel like there are aspects of noir to it or how is that working for you?
I definitely feel like these are noir novels. I mean, I kind of own it proudly, you know, that I am a neo-noir author. And, you know, within the publishing world, noir is kind of a word that or a genre that's kind of frowned upon because the thought is like that the readership is not that large as if you were writing a straight mystery or a thriller. But I like to think that I mix some of these elements so that it still is thrilling, but it does have what I say, the heart of noir, kind of the soul of noir, especially when I'm writing about Los Angeles.
Well, we're coming up to the end. Why don't you tell us how people can reach you, website, social media, and et cetera?
Sure. So my website is www.aaron, A-A-R-O-N, Philip, P-H-I-L-I-P, Clark, C-L-A-R-K.com. And you can also find me on Facebook just by typing in author Aaron Philip Clark. And I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at _ write me a world.
Okay. And you said a little bit about what your next project would be, but why don't you tell us more, a little bit more about that and when we might expect to see another book by Aaron Philip Clark out on the shelves?
Sure. So my next novel is titled All the Smoke. And it is a retelling highly inspired by the talented Mr. Ripley and many works by Patricia Highsmith. But it is centers on a sociopathic teenager who rises in the hip hop industry on the heels of a stolen rhyme book. And when the owner of that rhyme book gets out of prison, it brings a lot of conflict for my sociopathic rapper.
We've been speaking with Aaron Philip Clark, author of Blue Like Me and many other excellent mystery novels. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us tonight and take good care. Good luck with your career.
Thank you for having me. This has been great. I appreciate it.